Hey there, welcome to Marketing in the Raw. That is the name of the podcast, and my name is Adam Helway. I am the host. This is the place where I try to talk about things that help you expand how you define the practice of marketing and your vision of where it's headed, especially in a digitally connected world. Now, another little thing about me, I like sharing things here and there at the beginning of the podcast, especially when they connect with the episode. And the interesting part about this episode here is it connects with my background in the creative field. Back in the late 90s, I went to school for something that was then called new media. New media was just one of the many terms that they had at the time for multimedia or digital media. They were calling new media as anything that was experienced on a screen. And so I went to school for new media. Before that, I was dabbling in it before I decided to actually pursue it in school. And there were a number of tools out there. It was really, really young at that time. There were a few different players. There were tools for design and for creating downloadable interactive CDs. One of the things that was the hardest thing to do was actually to share this and experience it with other folks, because at that time the internet was still barely making it out into the mainstream. And so connections were super slow. Computers weren't really very powerful. Even just handing things off to folks, it wasn't easy to get a USB drive or burn something onto a disc. If you wanted to share music, for instance, and you had 30 minutes of music, you'd actually have to sit there for 30 minutes and let that CD burn on a one-to-one speed. Little did I know that 20 years or more later, that we would be seeing content and digital content playing such a big role in business and marketing and in general how people consume content. Digital media is something we're doing every single day in all different shapes or forms. And interactive media, because of the tools that people have developed and the platforms that we now have access to each and every day, is mainstream. Well, that's where I get to talk to my guest for this episode, Mark Cantor. He is a digital toolsmith and the CEO of his company, Instigate, his newest foray into digital media and creativity. As one of the original co-founders of Macromedia, one of the first big digital content creation tools, one that eventually was acquired by a little-known company called Adobe, he is a pioneer in the realm of digital and interactive media. Mark gives me the inside story about the early history of digital content publishing and interactive media. We get to talk about how digital media has evolved ever since meeting the thing called the internet. And we dive a bit into how the evolution of modern media platforms hold the key to how interactive media will be consumed. Lastly, he shares with me his vision of the future of interactive media. And I think you'll have to hear it because it will kind of blow your mind a bit. One of the last things to share is that this conversation happened with Mark and I back in mid-2019. So keep that in mind in context to the things that we talk about during this conversation. So if you're ready to go, strap on your seatbelt and get ready to enjoy the ride. Here's my interview with Mark Cantor. Mark Cantor, I'm so glad that you're available to talk. And you were, when we talked the last couple times, you came over, we enjoyed some barbecue and everything, and you brought up a lot of old memories that I just forgot that were there. And the way that you did that was you started talking about your background. And although we've known each other for quite some time, I didn't know how I missed the fact that you started one of the most pivotal companies in the space of digital creativity, multimedia, online, not even online publishing at the moment, had nothing to do with it. Macromine, which eventually turned into Macromedia, which eventually was acquired. They were a major competitor in a number of areas with Adobe, which then ended up acquiring them. But that's how I got started years and years ago. And so when we peeled that back a little bit more, you were sharing with me your real true background many years ago. Even before that, you got started because you were a creative. You started with music and a synthesizer and went from there. How the heck did you go from that to then turning around and creating this really pivotal software company that really kind of opened the doors in a lot of ways to this space of digital multimedia?
So I'm really blessed. I was in the right place at the right time. My high school had a Moog synthesizer. And we also had this teletype machine, this terminal. So they give us access to the teletype terminal. And the first thing we type is F-U-C-K, right? So they immediately kick us off the terminal, right? But meanwhile, I'm learning this synthesizer stuff while I was one of the only white kids who's in the choir. In fact, the choir lady called me the Great White Hope. So meanwhile, I'm this singer, and I discovered this school called Oberlin. Oberlin was one of five schools in the world that taught electronic music. So in 1975, I began studying at Oberlin as an opera singer. I got in with my voice, but I showed up with two reel-to-reel tapes because I had already had a portfolio from high school. So that allowed me to jump over all the intro classes. And there were 26 full-time electronic music students at Oberlin in 1975. We were learning PDP-8. We had the AIM-65 microprocessor. We were loading off programs in Tiny Basic onto cassette. And I was learning TTL logic. I could build circuitry. From there, I learned about this thing called a surge synthesizer. They eventually kicked out my guru. His name is Darijohn Mizell. Kicked him out of Oberlin. Of 26 students, 24 of us left. I took my music synthesizer and brought it to the Art Institute of Chicago and interfaced it to a video synthesizer. So now the voltages and triggers that were coming from the music were being used to drive and change the visuals. Okay? So this is when I coined the phrase, it's just as wrong to be a musician as an artist. These are old-fashioned terms based upon old-fashioned technology. Now we can make music with our paintbrush, and we can paint with our violin. That's called a computer. That was around 78. And since then, I've had this vision where art and music come together, and the third leg of the stool is interactivity and the computer.
And at that point, because I forgot that director... A big early product at Macromedia was actually one of the flagship products at the company that you started, right?
Right. Originally it was called VideoWorks. Then we added a programming language in it. Apple found out, and as of January 86, every Macintosh shipped with a disk that showed you how to use the Macintosh, the guided tour, and that was created with our disk. VideoWorks Interactive. We got some venture. Microsoft announced Windows. The Color Mac came out. And we got venture capital from a company called Kleiner Perkins, Caulfield and Byers. We had this guy named John Doerr on our board.
This guy, huh?
And we moved from Chicago to Silicon Valley. And they said, where do you want to live in the valley? We said, no, we want to live up in the city. So we were one of the first software companies in Soma. So... that product was then renamed. We were up to VideoWorks 2. That was the color version. So then we renamed the product Director, and we recruited out of Apple a guy named John Skull, who's the only difference between John Skull and John Scully was two letters and $5 billion in sales. Okay, so Skull became our CEO, and for the first 2 years, he pissed through five rounds of venture capital to the point where they finally kicked him out. As he's going down, he's blaming it on me. So then they kicked me out. And then eventually they started to merge the companies because this is now during the 89-90 downturn. And so, you know, you put money into a company in 88, you're expected to go public by 91. So Kleiner Perkins started merging in companies, merging, and thus begat Macromedia. So when it became Macromedia, I think it was up to Director 3. And then they went and bought 60 companies, of which Flash was one of them, Dreamweaver was another one. So this new management had we're not product guys. They were living on the coattails of what we developed, and they just went. Were Macromedia, where Flash bifurcated. Director was for the CD-ROM people, the bitmaps, and Flash was engineered for the very slow sip through a thin straw of data for at least the next 10 years. Only until around 05 was Flash able to get enough bandwidth that it could then, for instance, power YouTube. Okay, so all this is what's going on. I'm watching this whole thing like, wow, they kind of missed what the real model was with Macromedia. Macromedia was supposed to be a digital content publisher. We were the Black and Decker of tools, and we would go to these people and say, hey, now we want to be your publisher. That's what our original intentions were. So that all got lost.
So then, and again, you start stirring up all these memories between Flash and Director, and exactly as you described, right? If you wanted to build a standalone interactive experience, you would use Director. If right. you wanted to do something,
a little ad, or something.
Right? Yeah, exactly. You'd end up using Flash, and just like again the sift through the straw thing. I mean, I remember when this is years even later, when bandwidth just barely started getting faster, being able to sit for 15 minutes to wait for somebody's 2-minute Flash animation, and this is not even necessarily like something that I'm using as a utility. This is just an animation that somebody did where they were starting to create characters and put them on the web, and for no good reason other than to create, not even for the sake of advertising and such. So what was your dream? Because I mean, obviously as a creative, you really fell into the digital side as you were describing through your school and doing the music, and then that snowballed. But like your vision, what were you hoping people would do with these tools, and what did you see in fact happening? And just to note, this is kind of like you said, it's very early stages of the internet. I mean, the internet was still kind of, people didn't know if it was going to be a medium, and yeah. It was hard enough just to get Flash animations through it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it wasn't a medium, right? I would argue that until Netflix and YouTube, that the web wasn't a medium, right? Okay. So there was this newness, and that's what allowed you to sit there for 15 minutes and wait for the download, right? In fact, Macromedia went and created a site, a spinoff company called Shockwave.com, entirely dedicated to that, and that failed miserably. They raised like $75 million. So the newness of the web, and one of the themes of my life is to look forward and to see this newness and figure out, well, what enables or prevents the humans from taking advantage of that newness, the tools. So throughout the 80s, we were developing breakthrough tools to the point where now this company's public. I mean, my God, I need to go do something else with my life. And so I decided to dedicate my life to interactive music videos. Okay, so music videos were a big thing, but it was the interactivity quotient that was missing. I call it the three legs of the stool. Okay, so I created a band. It was called the Media Band. And we hired Todd Rundgren to be one of the producers. And we went and cast four people. We put a whole backstory screenplay. And for 2 years, I'm pouring all my money into this thing. And created a disc called Meet the Media Band. Okay, so that's what I was doing. And then I saw that maybe the entire format of interviewing would change if you could have interactivity. Like your viewers could now call in. And typically, if you had a chat thing there, they would ask a question. And then you'd ricochet that question to me. So I did the Mark Cantor show. And then I realized that I could bring all these things together in a venue. Because broadband at the time, 96, was still 10 years away. But if you are on a WAN in a physical place, you can have as much bandwidth as you want.
Yeah, yeah.
So I built a theme restaurant in my house on Potrero Hill. It was called the Media Bar. So this is what I'm doing with all my IPO money, in case you're wondering, right? Now, I never got a penny of investment. This is all just me doing boutique R&D, taking my concepts and deploying them, right? My hubris completely killed me. What I should have done is gone and worked for Sony or Time Warner or something and gone been their digital czar or something, because all these companies were figuring this stuff out and making mistake after mistake. My partner, Steve DiPaola, was the CTO of Saatchi & Saatchi, Okay, so all these jobs, all this money was getting spent, and I'm telling everybody, no, sorry, I don't need your money, right? So that was my attitude. I'm sitting up on the hill in Potrero Hill, throwing the most awesome parties you could ever imagine. This is when we figured out what was called flash mobs, right? Mm-hmm. So there'd be like 100-200 people at my house. We'd be raging. Everybody would whip out their phone and say, yo, come over to the house, you know? There'll be 500-700 people would show up, right? And there was actually three distinct kinds of parties. All the old hippies from around 8 p.m. till midnight would be there smoking dope, right? Between midnight and 2 were when all the alcoholics would show up. And we were friends with the guy who owned Sky Vodka, so he'd bring over cases of Sky Vodka. And then between 2 and 4 is when all the tweakers would show up, go into the bathroom, snort this white powder crap, and start slamming to EDM music, okay? So by 4, the cops would show up, everyone would leave, and then the next weekend we'd start over. So these were the scene I was in, and I had wired up my house with digital video, in theory, thinking about what would it be like when I would have Sonos and Netflix and YouTube built into my house. Okay, but again, 15 years before.
Yeah.
Okay? So that was my life that I led, truly believing that if I lived in the future, good things would happen. Now, it's all about timing, and I could argue that now, 20 years later, I'm now reaping the benefits of living that life, because in the aughts, we discovered this stuff called social, right? So I started building these social networks, not based upon monetizing users' data, but based upon what I thought users wanted, which was a place to come together virtually, right? Meanwhile, I've been spending a lot of time traveling around the world, going to Japan, Amsterdam, Hong Kong, working, doing, picking up gigs wherever I could, kind of bring this kind of mentality, this kind of attitude. So a lot of people know me out there, know me as like the independent guy, not the one who's ever gone to work for a big company, who's never modified his principles. I've always stuck to what I believe in, which is that the product should be designed for the user. It's not about the company making money. The company can make money along the way. It's about the value that you provide to the user. So I see myself as a toolsmith.
Well, you have a theme with all the things between director, the music that you initially started dipping your toes into on the digital side, Flash, and even the band. The theme is interactivity, right? You could have just created digital tools for creating music, better tools than what you were using, per se. You could have tried to improve on ways of publishing digitally at that time, and then you know, evolve that. But everything that you did has always had, again, as somebody who's used Flash and used Director, it's about how people could interact, not just creating just animations as a lot of people did, but using ActionScript and Flash so that people can interact with things on the web. What have been some of the drivers that have either held back the ability for other people to interact with media that somebody who had, you know, who's using these sorts of tools, the potential engagement and interactivity that people using these tools can impart into their work and their projects? What's been things that have propelled it forward in all these years that you've been? What are some of the trends and things that have helped that either hold it back or move it forward?
Okay, so there's two questions. One is, what are the key milestones and trends that have moved it forward? And the second, what have been the barriers?
Yes.
Okay, all right. So starting in the 80s, there was Zork and Eliza.
These names.
Okay? So those were new kinds of interactivity. And these Eliza guys figured out that if you pretended that you were a therapist, you'd actually believe that you were talking to a sentient being, okay? Right around the time we were doing Media Band, the director of Media Band, John Samwar, did a project called Psychic Detective, which is for the 3DO machine. And it was shot from three different points of view, video. So you could assume three different characters and play out this whole detective thing, okay? Jump forward. Last year, Netflix releases Bandersnatch.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
Awesome key milestone. Problem is, or shall I say challenge, that's technology from 20 years before. Psychic Detective was better than Bandersnatch, okay? Bandersnatch is so simple. Don't get me wrong, this is a key thing, mainly because of Netflix. Now, that then leads us to what are the barriers. berries have been about distribution. The shock I had in my life was when, because I got involved in this thing called interactive TV, and that actually preceded the web by 3 years. So I participated in a Pac Bell project called Media Park. They ran a 128K ISDN line into my home on Potrero Hill. That was like high-end bandwidth, 128K. And so we're sitting there out in San Ramon at the Bell, Pac Bell, this was before it was AT&T. And it was like, okay, so tell us about this trial, the Media Park trial. Okay, well, there were 30 vendors sitting there at the table. And, you know, this is at San Ramon where the Dilbert was born, right? So there's these long hallways of cubicles, you know, like 100 yards of cubicles. So this lady comes walking in with a plate of donuts. You go, oh, that's great. We'll get some donuts. And then she walks over and she sits at the head of the table and convenes the meeting. That's when you know you're in trouble, right? When the lady who's bringing the donuts is in charge of the project. Okay, this is AT&T. This is Pac Bell. So tell us about this test trial. Well, yeah, so we've been authorized by the FCC to do a trial. That's great. And you've got 30 vendors. Yeah. Okay, but when is it like deployed and how many customers are you expecting? Oh, no, we've not been authorized to have customers. This is just for the vendors. So they expected us to build this technology to be on this network for no customers. Okay? So then the next generation of interactive TV was coming from Intel. Their entire concept of interactivity was ads. That's all they wanted to do. And I'm thinking about a hotspot on the screen. And by the way, my friend Brad Horowitz had a company called Visage. They got the patent for that. He then went to work for Yahoo. Then he went to work for Google. He's now in charge of Google Photos. So there have been people around for years and years who've been trying to bring interactivity to this technology. And the problem has been the platforms. So why is it important that Netflix release Bandersnatch? Because they end up being a platform. You just see when it comes up on Netflix and it says skip recap or like all this interactivity. That's code, right? They can program anything if they want to. They just need to get, you know, Spielberg or Quentin Tarantino or somebody involved, right? He's going to really push the envelope. Not just interactive ads or skip over the recap. I mean, you got to push the envelope. So it always comes down to the platform. Like,
what the platform obviously has to be built, but in addition to it, it has to be available to the right audience and have enough adoption. So something like Netflix, obviously widely adopted, people have it in their home. It's pervasive.
100 million users.
Yeah, and so for doing something like Bandersnatch, like you said, it might be old hat, but
it's a toe dip. At least they're getting there. At least it's not about interactive ads.
So taking into consideration, obviously the platform, and so for those that are listening to this, that sounds obviously like it's really an important thing. I think I agree with them. I think that's why even for instance iOS or iPhone specifically, people might poo-poo it a little bit when they start to talking about which phone is better and this and that and the other. So it doesn't really matter in the end if the platform itself is not actually being used, if it's not easy enough for developers to access to create content for them. When you look at something like, in my personal opinion, the Android platform, it takes more effort to develop on the platform than it does to sort of plug in and get something going on the iOS side. That platform is there, and that's an advantage for Apple, and it's an advantage for those that want to publish.
The thing about Android, because I'm literally dealing with this right now, is that it's incredibly fractured, right? So there is no one Android. But let's take this conversation down a little bit of a different path. The thing that drives this stuff is killer apps. We learned that from the iPhone. Right? It's all about the apps. You'd be hard-pressed to point to an Android app that made Android, right? Android has 80% of the market share, but yet all the innovative new stuff keeps coming out on iOS. So let's go freestyle for a moment. The coming battles in the next 12 to 18 months are around the streaming platforms. And you know that everyone's pulling their content off of Hulu and Netflix, and it's going to go into Disney, Warner, Universal, right? So they're all going to have Comcast is Universal, and they're all going to have their own streaming platforms. Apple's going to show up with a streaming platform, and don't leave Jeff Bezos out. They're all going to have streaming platforms. So let's go vamp for a second. Marvel Universe. You try to keep track of all the storylines and the six stones and what's going on.
I'm a geek. I know all this stuff about it.
Could you imagine a Marvel Universe? Like, one of the things I love about Netflix is that if I bring... diving through a directory and I go into a show and then I dive deeper, it'll show all the director and the characters, and then they'll show the other movies that these directors or characters have been in, and then they'll show related shows. That's all standard AI stuff, right? Can you imagine that in the middle of the movie you stop and you could click on a character and get the background story? Well, that's because Zoltron slept with so-and-so and thus begat so-and-so. I mean, that's a simple usage of interactive.
Versus right now, right on Prime Video, they have the ability to stop on a particular scene and see
who's
in the scene and that sort of thing.
It's just one more extension. So yeah. I'm going to give you a story from 25 years ago. Back when I used to be famous, AT&T, now we're talking about the Bell Labs people, had a research facility on Canal Street in New York with this new technology called MPEG, okay? And what they were going to show me was two MPEG picture-in-a-windows on the same screen at the same time. And by the way, MPEG was 640 by 480, which is why they needed MPEG 2 before they could launch DVD. They renamed MPEG 2 DVD because you can't launch with 2. Right? I mean, well, what happened to one?
Yeah.
You know? Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm watching this MPEG 1 stuff, two PIPs on a screen, and they're introducing me to this concept called video on demand. And I think this is like 89 or 90, and I'm getting totally the inside kimono from the research labs, right? So they're showing me this thing, and they said, and then we have a thing called a database. And the database could have these things called movies. And you'd go and you'd select the movie, right? I said, this is awesome. So I look at the list, and there's Citizen Kane, my favorite movie. So I click on Citizen Kane, and up comes the little one-sentence description of Citizen Kane. The story of an overweight mogul and his sorry love life. Okay, now, what's wrong with this picture? You've got $1 billion of research. You think that this is the killer app, and for the next 10 years, interactive TV slogged this thing called on-demand. That's what their value-added was, right? That's a form of interactivity. But the problem was they hired some company in Kansas City to do the data entry describing, you know, those little paragraphs, the movie. Sorry, overweight mogul is not what Citizen Kane is about. So there I saw the problem. That these people who were writing the checks, designing the technology, building this thing, did not get the user experience. Reed Hastings understood that. Netflix got it. Everything before that was a joke. They don't even have standardized the term on demand. On Time Warner, it means this. On Comcast, it means that. I mean, the whole thing is a complete mess.
The user experience was being designed like a software product versus trying to look at it from the perspective.
And so Reed Hastings learned from a guy named Steve Jobs. And Steve Jobs learned that you could take an MP3 player and these movies, and he standardized on the contract. So all the music industry had to all agree to one contract format, a buck a song. And that's what begat iPod, right? And iTunes. So the user's experience, and this is why Jeff Bezos says the number one thing is the user. The user comes first. That's a simple principle. As long as you make a killer solution, and you know, go look at San Francisco. Why are there so many unhappy people? Because it's too expensive. They're all stuck in this rut. They're making $200,000 a year and barely a subsistence, right? Because they're working for some company that is so boring. Payments, rented a house, drive a car. I mean, I could see where maybe the first 2-3 years it might be fun. But in general, you know, these little Pinterest ads, in general, most of what the industry is fairly boring. Which is why these guys demand, or gals, demand more and more money just to stay at the job. If not, and the classic pattern is they go leave, right? So I just discovered this new product called Projector. Ex-Googler, ex-Twitter guys. And this is the pattern. They go work for these companies. They save up money. And then they leave and go start their startup. And if that fails, they just go back and work for the big co again, right? So the moral of the story is that the product is what matters. You actually have to do something that you wake up in the morning time and it's so hot and it's so fun and the feedback you're getting from the users is something that energizes you. You don't mind the fact that you're starving. Now, that's my life.
Well, and to also loop back around with something you were saying, you know, having the platform is one thing, but for those out there who are wanting to publish, you were saying that the customer experience is a huge thing that greases the wheels, which makes sense. I mean, customer experience right now is damn near a buzzword, you know, currently, and there are so many ways that technology right now is improving customer experience, both in social media and how humans are engaging with each other, but additionally how technology is greasing the wheels for folks, you know, when it comes to making it easier for people to purchase things. Or I mean, arguably what you're really talking about too is user experience, what we used to call user experience, right? Or UI.
Sure. I mean, you could parse it into small little details. For instance, there's a school of thought that says, do not call us consumers. Consumer implies that the purpose of my life is to buy things. Okay, so customer at least puts me in charge to say, I get to choose whether I'm going to pay money or not. And so you want to know, to me, the formula for how products fail? That you send me to this app. For whatever reason, I decide I'm going to go download this app. And the very first thing you're asking me for is my credit card. And telling me, well, I'll give you a free week. Well, dude, I'm not even convinced I want to use this product.
Yeah.
Perhaps I should try it out first. You know, it seems so obvious, you know. So at least when you call them customer, it puts the choice on, I get to decide.
By the way, I really agree with you. I definitely agree with you on that. And we, you know, we frame it as customers because I hate, for instance, when people say, we had this many users.
Yeah.
Was it? It makes it sound so mechanical and it takes the human element out of it, and that customers are people you serve. So when you frame it in that way.
Yes. And what's beautiful about this industry is that the serving, and okay, so there's a difference between a product and a service, right? And in both cases, because we've got the real-time web, I feel as though that product or service is an extension of that company. And I should be able to click, just reach out, and up comes the chat window and discuss a problem, right? That's actually an opportunity for companies, right? What so pisses me off is when they make it almost impossible for you to contact them, basically impossible to turn it off. God forbid I'm giving you this monthly fee, right? And it, you know, treats me like a user. Okay, if you understand that, if you treat me like a customer, it's a daily thing to keep me happy. Like, what, Whole Foods doesn't change the quality of their product on Thursdays. You know, they're always trying to deliver you the best quality experience, right? So the real-time web and all this technology stuff really gives us that ability to do that. For instance, compare Amazon Prime to Netflix. Netflix is rock solid. I can't get it to crash. And I'm crashing with Amazon Prime almost every day because I'm the kind of user that scrubs and goes back and jumps around a lot and pushes it. And poor little Amazon Prime, you know, and good news is that they're scaling up, but that ain't Netflix, right? So stability of software, quality of service, quality of the call center. I use a DNS called Hover, right? They're owned by Two Cows in Toronto. Every single time I've ever had a problem configuring my email, DNS, translate, boom, tap, 1, 2, 3, boom, the help guy is there. Helpful, friendly Canadian, solve my problem, go away. Other companies like, what is it, Meteor right now. We subscribe to a Meteor. It's another platform. 15 months later, we still can't turn the thing off. The charge is $30 a month. Yeah, I've been just going up to posting publicly on Twitter just to guilt them out, like, yo, dudes, you know. So, you know, customer service is all part of the product. You have to look at it as a holistic experience. You know?
Well, and looping back to the interactive stuff that we've been talking about, what do you think is the most? I mean, you talked about Flash empowering the I want to say the invent, but the In the background, it ended up being the first iteration of a format for YouTube.
Yep.
For the video there and a lot of other video stuff that was out there, but none that was as nearly as successful or impactful as YouTube. What is going on? What's going on currently? Where's the opportunity for businesses, for creatives, for brands wanting to sort of express themselves and create interactive experiences these days?
Wow. I see the top of the pyramid being streaming media and messaging. These are the two foundations. And in fact, if you started to pull out your platform chart or your stack, you'd quickly see that the old school model is, well, I've got this metaverse. I want you to come inside my walled garden, and I'm going to go charge you a monthly fee. I'm going to own your membership, and I'm going to try to keep you in there, right? And that's how they're using Siri and Alexa and Google now and Cortana. So whether it's AI or the game platforms, Twitch, they're all using that same mentality. Now, I believe that streaming and messaging can be a lingua franca standard, that if I was inside of, let's say, Fortnite, and I wanted to pull up a TV set, I should be able to dial up any channel. If I had a Netflix subscription and I was inside Fortnite, I should be able to see Netflix inside of Fortnite. Or Amazon Prime or Disney Plus. Okay? If I'm in Twitch and I'm chatting away, and by the way, Twitch does a million messages a second.
Yeah, this bonkers. Over
okay,
there.
So if I'm in Twitch and I'm chatting to my friends about this streaming game, well, shouldn't I be able to gateway to WhatsApp or Instagram or Facebook Messenger? Right, it's just messaging. It's pretty straightforward stuff.
But the barrier to that is usually the companies.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Not usually. Absolutely, the barrier. But if Tim Sweeney of Fortnite and the guy from Neil Stevenson, who's building Magicverse, which is from Magic Leap, Phil Rosedale, who did Second Life, who's now does High Fidelity, there are visionary people who get this, the fact that they can both maintain their own little walled gardens and get the monthly subscription fees, while at the same time, consider interoperability as just another feature. Like, who's on the list? You like a channel thing. Imagine it. Out in Walnut Creek, we're stuck with this thing called Wave. It's a really subpar quality cable television. When you go to, for instance, on demand of a show, they'll start with episode 4 and only show 3 episodes. Well, what about episodes 1, 2, and 3? I mean, like absurd things that prevent me from using my television. So that's because Comcast pays more money, and since Wave pays less, they don't get the full rights. So some lawyer somewhere thinks that they're going to try to extract more money out of Wave.
It turns into a half-assed customer experience, basically.
And that we're the ones who suffer from it. So it always comes down to what the company wants to do and where they think their money is coming from, how efficiently they are at spending their money, how big their bonuses are. If they're public, more times than not, they've taken out bank loans. The cable industry in general is saddled with debt, right? Leveraged bank buyouts come in, they buy out the company. It's ugly, right? High tech comes in with their bankroll. See, the big unanswered question in this industry is Apple's $300 billion. What are they going to do with that? Now, each of the other guys are sitting on $30, $50 billion, so they can basically do what they want. Could you imagine what Elon Musk would do with $300 billion? But Tim Cook doesn't know
what to do. We'd be on Mars already. Come on, Mark.
But Tim Cook doesn't know what to do. Johnny Ive doesn't know what to do with their money, right? So this is the classic scenario. And by the way, when we hear about all the 1%ers getting all the money, all the money's there. It hasn't disappeared. It's all in the hands of this stuff they call them private equity or limited partners or family offices. And they're just looking to spend the money. And they do that through venture capital, through things like the SoftBank Vision Fund. And so it's all about matching this cash with these entrepreneurs, right? So now along comes Steve Case, who's been down in the trenches, built up AOL. And he goes, well, wait a minute. You sure that everything can only happen in Silicon Valley, maybe a little New York and Boston? You know? So he's been out there riding around in a bus, promoting entrepreneurism all over the place. Okay, I moved to Cleveland to really understand what it's like out in the hinterlands. Right. So this connecting of the outliers and realizing that the innovation and the spirit of entrepreneurism is certainly not locked up here. And the company I'm building is a virtual company. My partner's in Vancouver. I have programmers in Bangalore and Lexington, Kentucky. And I found a young guy in Boston. And I'll be bopping around the world spreading our software because the Apple Store and Play Store work everywhere. That's my customer base, right?
As we're sort of wrapping up here, I want to go there a little bit and talk about, it was interesting because as you were talking about for you, you felt that the biggest opportunities currently in sort of interactive media was in streaming media and in messaging. And then as you were saying it, and I think you pretty much said it probably is, they really right now are married together in a lot of different formats, right? Again, when you think of things like Twitch or even what's going on with YouTube and YouTube
Zoom,
Live. And,
right? So you go, you fire up Zoom, we've got our chat window and that's how we're keeping our notes, right? Slack, Facebook Messenger, they're all a mixture of messaging and video.
So can you share a little bit about what's next, what you're working on?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So chatbots and AI were the first kind of knee-jerk reaction to how AI deploys out in the world, right? And the problem they're solving is tech support, and it's expensive to keep humans on the other end of the line. And so, I could have these chatbots, and the chatbots will answer 80% of the questions, right? But I'm not a business guy. I don't build business systems. I build creativity tools, okay? Ways that humans can express themselves. In the 80s, it was multimedia. In the 90s and early aughts, it was this thing called blogging. Then along comes YouTube and changed everything. And then along came Snap and Instagram. So if you follow that trajectory, you would assume that somehow getting these humans to control AI so that they can do for AI what director did for multimedia. Enable a normal human who doesn't have to be a programmer, enthusiastic young person, goes to Diablo Valley College or like whatever, and they have the energy, they get the tool, and then they can create things that are fun and compelling. Okay. Now, the secret of MacroMind was that we were video game guys and we were developing a video game tool. What we didn't know is that animated business presentations, product simulations, scientific visualizations, educational software, all could be built with the same tool. So the most exciting thing about Instigate, which is the company I'm working on right now, is what I don't know. I'm a toolsmith. We're going to create a range of possibilities with video selfies, everything that's on my phone, my ability to hold my phone in front of my face and talk. And that's how I program or train my own sentient being. I'm Geppetto, and I'm going to train Pinocchio. And we got this working, right? And the cool thing is that because of today's day and age and so much money that's out there and how much money it costs to develop AI, we've got a strategy that will get us to having a product this summer, and it's costing me $0 and 0 cents. I've got programmers who are so enthusiastic about the idea that we know that if we can get even a prototype out there and gradually walk our users through the levels, just like you're in a video game and you're walking your way up through the levels of the game, so too will our tool. You work your way through the tool, starting with memes, and you create a meme, and then you say, well, how can I give intelligence to this meme so that I share it with my friend, and then my friend can chat at it, and the meme answers back. And the meme only says what I tell her to say, right? So instead of the AI being decided by the company, the AI is controlled by me. It only says what I tell her to say. That's an AI authoring system. But how do you build that with zero money? That's what Instigate's first version will be this summer.
We talked about this before, and I'm really excited to see this because there's so much potential in especially the way that social media works these days between people sharing memes or shared experiences online, where what you're talking about is not just somebody who could potentially share an experience they're having with an interactive element such as that, but share it with you so you could have your own unique experience with that same
thing.
Right,
I take the same seed and I share it 10 times. It's going to create 10 different conversations, right? And by the way, at the same time, while we have streaming video, we also have the era of vines, these short little things, 6 seconds, 10 seconds, 15 seconds. And so one of the paths, one of the problems I'm solving is what do you do with all these short little videos that all these tools create, whether it's Boomerang or like all these products, yeah, right? Yeah. And so what you're doing is stitching together, you're weaving a tapestry of potential so that you can instigate a conversation. You're not saying, do this conversation. I'm going to give you the possibility. I'm going to instigate a conversation. And based upon who you are and how you're interacting with it, we'll begat a different conversation.
So I don't know when everybody else will be able to see this, but I'm hoping that you'll share with me in an early iteration.
Dude,
I would
right
love
now
it.
I'm literally talking to Bangalore. It's working on Android. We got bugs with Flutter and Dart, so it's not working on iOS. Believe me, dude, it's coming down the wire.
The second, I mean, I would that just it really does sound incredible. It sounds like something very. It's one of those concepts where you don't clearly understand the possibility. And I'm sure, I think you're kind of saying that as well, where you don't entirely, you know roughly the possibility, but you'll really know.
I'm sitting here scripting conversation templates, right? Various topics. Memes versus tropes. Frida Kahlo. Charlie Chaplin in modern times, right? So, because I'm going to create these things that are interesting to me and my generation, but this product is really for my daughter, right? What does she talk about? That teacher that they hate, that cute new boy in school, the movie we saw last weekend, the concert we're going to see this weekend, and they talk in their own language. They're quoting Cardi B. They're quoting lyrics from songs. And that's the language that she and her posse share. In this early version of the prototype, she'll be able to share with her friends. Later on, once we get funded, she's going to be able to push that live. And onto this live list of these example beings will be celebs and brands and tutorials and a whole range of these other things. And just like we learned HTML by going and say view source, you'll go into this being and you'll just double click and open up the script and you'll see the script for the being. Then you can go copy, paste, customize, personalize, mix and match all these different elements. My dream is to have a Beyonce being. And she spent $100,000, $250,000, pouring in.
Not an Beyonce. Sorry, that's a really bad joke.
Well, of course, she will get a percentage of the company since she got. You heard her deal with Uber, right?
No.
Yeah, she got It was a $6 million gig, and she got it all in Uber stock.
Oh my God!
It's now worth $300 million.
Oh my God!
So we'll do the same deal with her. She'll pour in 100 videos into her being. Baby videos, backstage, story of her lyrics of her songs, you know, romantic nights with her husband, and all that's in there. Now, I, as a user, I've created my own little being, but I'm also still going around and seeing, getting inspired. I land on the Beyonce being, and there she's got all this incredible stuff. There'll be a button there called Adopt. I can then go grab something from Beyonce and paste it in here. And go to Tesla and grab some stuff or Kellogg's, right? And mix and match, and it's a modern day remix. This is the culture that the digital natives expect.
Yeah, and I would say 6 or 7 years ago, I would say this sounds like something so out there that I don't see how folks would adopt it just yet. But these days, between TikTok and like you said, Instagram and Twitch.
And you know, and Fortnite has 100 million users who just use Create, which is kind of like its own Minecraft. So you don't have to go shoot and kill in Fortnite. You can just hang out and build things.
Just like a Mario Maker, Minecraft, exactly. All that sort of stuff. Yeah. Well, so here's the big final question for you. Now, you can refuse to answer it. It's all good. It'll be all fine. But could you sing a little opera? Can you give me a note of the opera? I know you.
Got any requests?
I wouldn't even know what to request. You know, like, I killed the rabbit.
No, okay. So, you know, one of the most famous operas is La Traviata.
Okay.
Do you know the theme of La Traviata?
If I hear it, I might.
It's a famous, well, you know, if I'm. Vediamo, pincere,
vede. Yes.
Okay. But the real story is it's a famous storyline about a courtesan who seduces a rich guy. So the opera of Ariel, quickly sing an excerpt of, is the father of the rich guy telling the courtesan, "You're a tramp, you're no good for my son. Get out of here." Ni provenzal mali sol, il al cor di cancellor, ni provenzal mali sol, e non puron geniso. E non tai non to soffri di squalor e di squalor, e non tai non to soffri di squalor. I'll jump to the chase. I forgot the words. E
yes.
From La Traviata. Yes.
Well, Mark, I love talking to you, man.
Beautiful.
Thank you very much.
And thank you so much for having me. Let's do it again.
We will.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to Marketing in the Raw. We love that you spent time with us. There's so many other podcasts out there and things to do in general, and you spent it with us. If there was one favor that I could ask of you, it would be that you subscribe to this podcast. And if you've already done that, then if you could rate and review the podcast wherever you listen to it, wherever you download it and subscribe to it, that would be incredible. Incredible. It helps other folks find the show. And lastly, if you've done both of those things already, if you could share this episode with somebody that would find it useful, the topics in this would help them out. It would make their day. It would pique their interest, something like that. It would be awesome if you could go ahead and share this with them. And last but not least, if you just want to connect, you have questions about anything in the show, you want to send me an interview, potential person to talk to or idea, or you want to talk about digital marketing, go ahead and email me at adam@secretsushi.com or just visit secretsushi.com. Until next time, thank you. Take care.